Hi, I'm Julia.
And I'm Henning.
And we're from Round Top. And you're listening to WGXC Acra, 90.7 FM in Acra, Hudson, and Catskill.
Got questions about technology, cybersecurity? Whether it's a remote car starter or jellyfish, try your luck at stumping our panel on the Thingularity radio program. Just send your questions to CatskillMakersInfo@gmail.com. That is CatskillMakersInfo@gmail.com. And one of our many interns will be electroshocked into inducing an answer for your listening pleasure. Listen to the Thingularity radio program every first Thursday of each month at 7 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM or anytime at WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community of...
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, you are listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. The name is show. Good night, Norman. The venue, WGXC. 90.7 FM, Hudson, Catskill, Acre, New York, WGXC dot, excuse me, ORG, on the worldwide interweb. Tonight, as promised, more fiction. I'm going to start off with something by René, or as they say in France, or some people say in France, René Dommard. It's from his Pataphysical Essays. First piece I'm going to read by him. It's called On Human Fauna. One. On Patagraphic Sphinxes. Patagraphy, decomposing the totality of a man, reveals the animals of which he is the synthesis. The model of the man thus analyzed is the Sphinx, conforming to the image propounded by Socrates, who conceived of the human soul as a harmonious mix of sage, lion, and snake, all enclosed in the same bag of skin. Depending on the subject, and even depending on the moment, sometimes one animal will predominate over the other. Two, on the paucity of men. It will be noticed then that among these beings that we charitably call our fellow creatures, few deserve the designation of quote-unquote man that we grant them. Nearly all of them are disguised animals. In truth, each man is the synthesis of a multitude of animals, but one of these animals has often developed to the detriment of the others. And although we believe we are addressing a man, it is rather a worm, a pike, a sheep, a wolf to which we are feeding the language that fattens him. Thanks to the intelligent practice of our pedagogic art, we will from now on be aware of with whom we are dealing. Three. On a few quick techniques of perfunctory patascopy. If we are traveling, taking a walk, sitting in a cafe, in a public meeting, etc., it often happens that we do not have within reach the necessary tools to pedagogically examine those with whom we are conversing. We can, however, very often reveal in a rather precise manner what type of animal is hiding behind the human appearance before us. We shall describe a few of these techniques. I apologize for all of these little throat clearings and whatnot. 4. Techniques by direct provocation. 1. By sameness. We throw to the interlocutor all kinds of bait, likely to whet the appetite of all kinds of animals. We attentively observe the rascal and carefully note his reactions. And so we speak nonchalantly, but in an intimate tone, going on about a warm stable, the cows we're going to milk, the steaming milk in the pails. And his face lights up, takes on color. He can barely manage to repress a soft whistling coming through his hip lips. That man was a grass snake. Or let's talk about sheep. Poor sheep. Tender sheep. Delicious lambs. Our neighbor turns purple and bares his fangs. He was a wolf. The examples are endless. 2nd technique by direct provocation, by difference. Same technique, except that instead of inducing reactions of desire, we bring forth anger, disgust, indignation. N.B. Here, psychoanalytic methods can be applied, but we must not forget that heretofore they have been limited to the exploration of sexual fauna, snakes, lizards, etc. 5. Technique by patoscopic liquors. Liquors will be prepared containing in carefully calculated homeopathic doses those substances apt to whet the appetite of the animals to be detected. They will be mixed with wines or spirits that will be offered to the subjects on the purely amicable pretext that it is something to drink. Very quickly, they will reveal themselves as being what they are. 6. Preparation of patoscopic liquors. Let us suppose we want a liquor capable of detecting goats. We place a well-chosen specimen of the animal in the field of our device. Our preference will be to use the mirror of solidified hydrogen. The focal sphere is filled with virgin pataplasm. We shall obtain the goat patogram. But we will have taken the precaution of making the beast fast for a week. We will have enforced an absolute sexual abstinence on his part for 3 months, deprived him of all movement for 5 days, of sleep for 3 days, and of drink for 2 days. We will have kept him for 2 weeks in a darkened room. The patogram thus produced will be an absolutely pure expression of the goat's desires. We thus have a pataplasm laden with the desired nourishment, but negatively so. To reverse the charge, we shall patograph the first pataplasm. Then we shall have pure goat nutriplasm from which we can extract a serum that will make up the essential portion of our liquor formulated thus. Nutriplasmic serum, 0.0000075. Guano, 1.85. Blood sausage juice, 9.165. Cephalospinal liquid of a normal man, QS per 1,000 centicreams. one drop in 3 liters of Aramon. That's a vine stock wine. Oh my. Wait a minute. Okay, that was a footnote. And it jumped me right out of where I was at. Now I'm mad. Okay, back to human fauna. One drop in 3 liters of Aramon, or in a liter of aged aquavit, poured directly down the gullet, will generally be enough to produce the desired results. 7, patoscopic liquor complete formulation. Same preparation, but instead of one animal, we place all possible animals in front of the device. Thanks to several centuries of effort, we have been able to collect in our cellars a reserve of 6 casks of this complete serum. A few drops of Lacrimae Rerum will ensure that it is perfectly preserved. This liquor can thus be applied to all cases without distinction, with one exception. 8. On the exception of the borderline insect. It can indeed happen that no particular reaction, except for heavy sleep, will take place in the subject after absorption of the liquid. Here we have before us a borderline case of entomological evolution. The man is no longer even an insect, but just a simple machine. Generally a machine for fulfilling this or that social function, but sometimes also an adding machine. In the first case, he never responds to your words in a manner that might hint at the slightest interest. In the second case, he takes hold of your speech so greedily that you think, what a monstrous animal, heretofore unknown, is hidden in this form of Homo sapiens, which our patoscopic serum is not capable of revealing. Think again, my dear fellow. You are in the presence of neither a man nor an animal, but rather of an adding machine. And any food, drink, or word that you try giving him will immediately be transformed into lubricating oil to apply to the machine's complicated gear wheels. 9. From autotomy to lycanthropy. I guess it's lycanthropy, sorry. Primitive peoples all over the world are aware of lycanthropic practices. Taking quote-unquote lycanthropic in a very broad sense of the word, which allow one to turn into an animal or of some sort. From what we have noted concerning human fauna, we can easily understand that a man as a harmonious mix of highly diverse animals can develop a given animal form in himself for a certain period of time. But this is still only subjective lycanthropism. The man maintains externally his human form, all the while feeling internally and acting outwardly like a crab, a fly, or a grizzly bear. Pataphysical experimentation and thought, in conjunction with the data from zoological psychology, have made it possible for us to devise an objective technique of lycanthropy, allowing anyone to change internally or externally into whatever animal one wishes. It will become clear later on that this is in fact a matter of bringing to consciousness and prematurely realizing the process of metempsychosis. But let us not get ahead of ourselves. I continue. The physiological basis of experimental lycanthropy must first be sought in the autotomic activity displayed by many so-called quote-unquote inferior animals. As any animal, and man in particular, can decompose into the complete series of previously existing animals, it will be enough to bring about a metamorphosis for man to decompose into a system of animals all endowed with the autotomic property. But let us first turn our attention to that function among quote-unquote inferior animals. We will leave aside the autotomy particular to unicellular beings, infusorians, bacilli, etc., which is a purely reproductive function, leading simply to quantitative multiplication and the creation of similar beings. Let us immediately take up the case of differentiated animals that exhibit the autotomic property. For the same reasons cited above, we will disregard the autotomic properties of annelids and other animals able to divide by segmentation, fragmentation, and quantitative augmentation are of no interest to us. If an earthworm is cut in two, are we any further along in pataphysical terms? Most assuredly not. And so then, we will just point out that certain annelids can, with no outside interference, break up into separate sections. This is what is meant by autotomy. The only type of autotomy worthy of attracting our pataphysical attention is the one by which certain animals break apart by expelling their own organs. Let us pay highest tribute to the holothurian, more commonly known, once it has been half putrefied, then dried, by the name of trepang, or sea slug, or sea cucumber, and highly prized by the Malayans and the Chinese. The holothurian autotomizes by vomiting its digestive tract inside out. For that matter, every member of the family of Holothuriodia outdoes the next when it comes to self-evisceration. The starfish, known for its fits of temper, has until now never been known to make any but vain attempts at autotomization. Moreover, it has lowered that practice to debased utilitarian goals. Thus, it is that in order to eat its customary prey, the mussel, it devaginates its stomach and wraps the mollusk in it. And so it digests it outside itself. After which re-invagination occurs. Polyps and medusas also perform autotomy when they shoot out their stinging cells. Some authors have seen a case of autotomy in the fact that certain annelids discard their phosphorescent scales. In our opinion, these annelids are in most cases not autotomizing any more than are you or I when we lose our hair. The phenomenon of phosphorescence, which frequently accompanies the process of decomposition, can mislead only naive intellects. In like manner, when arthropods, crabs, crawfish, grasshoppers, etc., discard one of their appendages, leg or pincer, the division is purely mechanical, not organic. A crayfish pincer is not an autonomous organ. My God, that autotomy threw me off there. A crayfish pincer is not an autonomous organ, let alone a separate animal. It is only part of a crayfish, unable to live when separated from the body. A stomach, on the other hand, is in itself a kind of animal, provided that the plexuses that drive it are intact and it gets a sufficient blood supply. It can continue to digest all by itself once it is separated from the body. When the holothurian expels its digestive tract, it is very close to being able to go on living as a new animal. So, we will persist in taking the holothurian as the most exemplary case of autotomic segmentation. All right, you've heard it here first. Maybe not. Maybe you've read René Dommal before. And I'm just being presumptuous. All right, we're going to break away from Mr. Dommel for a little bit and turned to a more contemporary writer. His name, J. Robert Lennon, and this is from his collection of stories titled Let Me Think. Girls. The girls don't want to be seen except when they want to be seen, at which time they're easy to find. But when they don't want to be seen, which is usually, to find one is rare. A visitor who knows about the girls and believes that their ability to conceal themselves has been overstated will sometimes see one who wants to be seen and announce, not without a certain smugness, that he has seen one of the supposedly elusive girls, and that there isn't much to their storied invisibility after all, is there? But then the visitor will be told, sometimes by the girl herself, that she was not, in fact, hidden, and the visitor will scoff, and then the girl will vanish. Of course, the girls aren't really invisible. They are merely skilled at concealment. The tactics they employ are known to include, but are likely not limited to, blending into backgrounds, extreme stillness, stealthy wardrobe changes, strategic irrelevance, agreement, small size, false modesty, physics, prayer, smoke cloud. The girls are excellent judges of character and are thought to tailor their methods to the persons who they believe are seeking them. This, in any event, is what they've told us. Around the age of 14 or 15, the girls lose their abilities. Some young women make fruitless efforts to retain them well into their 20s, but these efforts are regarded as socially unacceptable, and such young women are shunned. Outsiders assume that women should regain their abilities once they reach old age or otherwise lose their desirability, but this glib assumption is wrong and evinces a fundamental misunderstanding of the girls' role in our community. Most find such logic offensive. Once the ability is lost, it cannot be regained. Women rumored to have relearned concealment are generally later found to have died or moved away. Most women don't miss their juvenile powers. They don't remember how they did it. They don't care. Why should they? It must be admitted that very few women are thought to remain concealable for their entire lives. There are stories of ostensibly missing girls found dead in their homes decades later as old women, the implication being that they were present all along but unseen. Our museum features an exhibit of journals thought to have been written by such women. The entries read, quote, watch them eat dinner, unquote, and, quote, bus didn't stop for me, end quote. The journals, however, might be hoaxes. Most women think so, but the men want to believe. This is titled Boys. The boys are expressing themselves through their bodies. They're making themselves known by a series of sudden motions, some fluid, most of them jerky, awkward, startling. They want you to react. The boys would like to be praised for the movements they have performed. To that end, they have composed sample comments and written them on 3x5-inch note cards in their execrable handwriting, and they pass these out to the girls and adults. Some of the cards read, I am very impressed by your poking. Your jumping out from behind that tree was excellent. We love you very much. Thank you for convulsing in the grass. Your spasms have improved my day. Everything about your clapping is delightful. The boys have something they want to show you. They take you by the hand and lead you somewhere, an open field, a beach, a playground, a parking lot. When you reach the destination, there's nothing to see. The boys have become distracted or wandered off. It is possible that they just wanted to relocate you. You were aware that this might happen, but of course you went anyway. The boy's enthusiasm is so infectious. You pretend to yourself that your new placement is actually kind of interesting, that the boys had it in mind all along that what you really needed was a change of scenery. Don't ask them if that's what they intended, though. They're onto other things now. For instance, they are disrobing. The boys want to be naked. They laugh uproariously at one another's behinds and penises. You quietly encourage them to put their clothes back on, the pants at least, but instead they cover things with urine, a tree stump, some ants, a chain-link fence. It's not clear whom these boys belong to. There are lots of adults around, but none claim ownership. The girls are off somewhere on their own. The boys make you uncomfortable, not just their nakedness, their demeanor. Indeed, their very existence seems to impugn your moral authority, your sense of self. You don't wish to meet the gazes of the other adults. You are ashamed. But the boys are enraptured by their own corporeality. They are horribly alive. Oh, my right is here. Oh, just kidding. Anyways, this is called Want, Cain. In the park, I was sitting one bench down from an old man reading a neatly folded newspaper. A wooden cane fashioned from a hardwood branch, sanded and lacquered, leaned against his knee. The man had the air of having done this exact thing every morning for decades. He didn't look up as people passed. He just read his paper and occasionally rested his free palm on the head of the cane and gently rocked it. Then a long-haired kid came pounding by in old running sneakers and baggy jeans and snatched the cane away, just blew past like a gust and seized the cane with the greatest refinement and delicacy and without the slightest adjustment to his stride. It took the old man a second or two to notice. A little flutter at the corner of his paper and the cane was gone. A couple of burly guys saw it happen and took off after the kid. I asked the old man if he was all right, but I didn't really care. I was jealous of the kid, I mean. I wanted the cane. I wanted to be able to steal a thing with such grace, to be young and an asshole again. This is called Want, Nut. The kid, not my nephew, but my cousin's wife's brother's kid, whatever that makes him, reached across the Thanksgiving table and took a nut. I think it was a pecan from the white china bowl. He had to sort of half stand up to do it and nearly upset the gravy boat with his shirt sleeve in the process, but he managed in the end, grabbed the nut, sat back down, and readied himself to pop the thing into his mouth. But Great Uncle Luther said, "You really wanted that nut, didn't you, kid? You're like a little squirrel over there, huh? You just have to have that goddamn nut." The kid sat there with his mouth open, maybe trying to figure out how he should take this, or wondering whether he should eat the nut, or put it back, or what? "If I tried to take a nut like that," Great Uncle Luther said, "my old man would have beat me bloody. A nut was worth something in those days." The kid shrugged and ate the nut. Later that night in the kitchen, Great Uncle Luther told my mother to get her fat ass out of the way. She punched him in the teeth. You listen to me, your host, Norman Douglas, the name of the show. Good night, Norman. Right here on WGXC 90.7 FM. Go to the website, wgxc.org, and donate some money to this non-profit community radio station so you can hear me and other great broadcasters for as long as you can hear it. Okay, this is this next story is called Blue Light, Red Light, from Book of Stories called Let Me Think, by Mr. Lennon, spelled like John, but no relation. Maybe he is, I don't know. Blue Light, Red Light. The boy was 5. For some time, his whole life until recently, he had been an only child. But then there came a baby. The baby was a girl. The boy was initially inclined to dislike the baby, as upon its arrival it became the center of other people's attention, attention that had once been his alone. But as the months passed, he found himself increasingly compelled by the baby, its face, its small hands and feet, the way it was willing to stare at him for hours, or what seemed like hours to the boy, for whom time was malleable and uncertain. And so after long consideration, the boy grew to like the baby. One evening, soon after the baby arrived, when the boy couldn't get to sleep, he was permitted to stay up with the mother and the father and watch television. The parents nodded off, and a new show came on, a true crime show. The boy watched it. On the show, a criminal had broken into a house and killed the family, including a baby with a knife and a club. Neighbors, friends, and relatives told the police that the family had recently experienced problems with a crazy man in their neighborhood. The crazy man was addicted to drugs and had intended to rob the family to buy more drugs. But instead of merely robbing them, he killed them. The police found the man hiding under a bridge in another town, surrounded by the family's possessions. Among the images displayed on the true crime show over a soundtrack of ominous music were photos of the dead family members with their faces blurred, lying on their backs in pools of blood. The boy saw these photos. When the show was over, the boy went to bed. He didn't tell the mother and the father what he'd seen. It seemed to the parents that the boy had forgotten the show, but he expressed worry about the baby. He asked the mother and the father if they locked the nursery door at night. No, of course not, they said. You should, the boy told them. Well, we can't, said the parents. We're always going in and out of there in the dark. The boy didn't argue. One night he locked the nursery door from the inside, then pulled it closed before he went to sleep. This made him feel better. When the baby cried in the night, the parents couldn't get into the nursery, and the boy heard a lot of shouting. The father eventually got the door open with a screwdriver. The boy was punished the next day. Treats were withheld. He didn't lock the nursery door again. He pondered the crazy man more and more. This was a real person. He had actually killed a baby. The police said they had caught him, but what if the man escaped? The boy lay awake at night. Sometimes he cried. He would get out of bed and go into the nursery to make sure the baby was still there. One night it wasn't, and he screamed, but the mother had merely taken the baby out of its crib to feed it. The parents were angry at the boy again and punished him again, but the boy didn't care about treats anymore. The boy checked surreptitiously the locks on all the doors in the house before he went to bed each night. He disguised this behavior by explaining that he was looking for a lost toy, which he would then find in his bedroom. Soon he began locking doors during the daytime as well. When the boy remembered that the crazy man on the show had gained entry to the house by climbing through an unlocked window, he found the window lock mechanisms and added those to his security routine. He wasn't tall enough to reach every window lock, but he had a plastic stool that he could carry from window to window for the high one. It was hard to do all this without being detected. The father said, "Who in the hell keeps locking all these goddamn windows?" "Not me," the mother said. The boy also denied it. "Well, it can't be Emily, can it?" the father said. Emily being the name of the baby. The boy overheard conversations between the parents that he understood were about him and about his fixation on the door and window locks. He was taken to a doctor and asked why he performed this locking behavior. But the boy did not want to tell anyone about the crazy man under the bridge, so he told the doctor that he was afraid of monsters. The doctor wanted to know what the monsters looked like, and the boy, thinking quickly, said that they looked like the father, except completely covered with hair. The parents did not bring the boy back to the doctor after that. Instead, the four of them, the mother, the father, the boy, and the baby, visited a department store at the mall where the parents bought an object in a white cardboard box. In a photo printed on the side of the box, a baby slept peacefully in a crib while in the foreground a large featureless globe emitted a calming blue light. At home, the father opened the box. The globe was inside. It was made of white plastic and rested on a small white plastic pedestal. But when you plugged it in and turned it on, it glowed blue. The boy could read a little, and he knew from the box that this object was called Baby's Calming Globe. But the boy was to learn that it had another function. That night, the father sat on the floor of the baby's room with the boy. The boy wore his pajamas, and the father smelled pleasantly of beer. The father said, "What this thing does is it scans the house constantly, making sure everything is safe. It's blue now, see? That means the doors and windows are locked, and there are no monsters inside or outside. Blue means safe. If anything is wrong, and believe me, it's really sensitive with top-of-the-line technology, it'll turn red. You got that? As long as this light is blue, everything is fine. And you don't have to check the windows and doors. We only have to worry if it turns red. Okay?" The boy said okay. The father clapped the boy on the shoulder, then told him it was time for bed. When the boy's mother came in to say goodnight, she asked if he felt safer now, and the boy said that he did. Later, the boy heard the parents talking in low voices, and then he heard them laughing. And then everything was silent, and the boy lay alone, staring into the dark of his bedroom. The boy had lied to his parents. He didn't feel safe. In fact, as he understood the situation, the parents had just confused with their purchase of Baby's Calming Globe the existence of the very dangers that had frightened him. The parents had confirmed, not confused. Sorry about that. The very existence of the dangers that frightened him. That the parents had alerted him to the true nature of the device indicated that they trusted him to help them protect the baby. And now, instead of staying awake to monitor the light, they'd gone to sleep. So the boy gathered up his blanket and pillow and stationed himself on the floor in the hallway. Outside the nursery, blue light glowed through the crack under the door, and the boy could hear the baby turn over and babble in her sleep. In the morning, the boy found himself back in bed, underneath the blanket, his head on the pillow. He leaped out of bed, alarmed, but his family were all fine, awake and sitting at the breakfast table. They gazed at him with what looked to the boy like disappointment. They didn't mention the previous night. The boy said nothing, just sat down and ate his cereal. The next several nights were the same. The parents went to sleep. The boy reported for duty at the nursery door. Then at some point, the boy woke up in his own bed. Clearly, the parents were moving him there, perhaps when the mother rose to nurse. At times, throughout each day, the boy would steal into the nursery to have a look at the light, to make sure it hadn't turned red. Sometimes, incredibly, it was switched off, and the boy would switch it back on. After a few days, the parents got the message and left the light on all day. The parents' unconcern was puzzling, even alarming to the boy. They never seemed to monitor the light themselves, day or night. And when they expressed dismay, it was not at the danger they all faced, but at the boy's preoccupation with the blue light. "Buddy, look at it," the father said, in evident frustration. "It's blue. It's always blue. That means we're safe." The boy nodded as though he understood. Were the parents stupid? Did they believe that the light itself protected them? The boy's fears deepened. The parents were incompetent. Weeks passed. The boy's vigil continued, and the parents did less and less to dissuade him from continuing it. Indeed, they seemed resigned to it. Meanwhile, the boy began to wonder by what mechanism exactly the monitor light worked. How could the machine tell the difference between safety and danger? Perhaps it could distinguish a stranger from a family member, like the mother's phone, which worked only when she looked at it, or violent motion from ordinary movement. While the father was at work and the mother had the baby in the kitchen, the boy performed experiments. He dressed up in his Darth Vader costume and presented himself to the light. He seized his stuffed Chewbacca and staged a mock fight. He could not trigger the red light. Perhaps baby's calming globe was more sophisticated than the boy had originally believed. Perhaps it was capable of distinguishing pretend violence from real violence. But this seemed unlikely. The boy was growing concerned that his parents had been deceived. It would be necessary to test the device, to present it not with fake danger, but real danger, of a sort that the boy could control. There wasn't much time. It was late summer, not long before school was to begin. The boy formed a plan. He waited until the mother had experienced a sleepless night, rising at all hours to tend to the baby. After a long morning of sitting in the neighbor's weed patch playing his handheld video game, the boy was served lunch. Then his mother said, "I'm going to feed your sister." She went into the living room, slumped on the sofa with the baby, and nursed. Soon, both of them were asleep. The mother sprawled face up with her head thrown back and breast exposed, and the baby sprawled face down on the mother. Their postures reminded the boy of the dead family from the true crime show. The boy hurried to his room and pulled out from under the bed a cardboard box of old newspapers and wood shavings he had collected from the shed. From a kitchen drawer, he retrieved the butane lighter his mother used to light the often temperamental oven. He placed the flammable items box on the nursery floor, checked to make sure the baby's calming globe was switched on, and set fire to the shavings and newspaper. The nursery filled with smoke. Now, to the boy's surprise, the flames leaped high into the air and licked at the lacy cloth that covered the baby's changing table. The lacy cloth caught with a gasp and was quickly consumed. The fire then moved to the curtains, which had been made by the mother from a fabric printed with bumblebees. Now the smoke began to pour out the door into the hallway, and the flames began to darken the ceiling. Baby's calming globe was still blue. Everything happened fast after this. The fire alarm in the hall emitted a shrill squeal. The mother appeared, holding her blouse closed with one hand and clutching the baby in the other. She screamed, ran down the hall, and returned with a fire extinguisher in place of the baby. But she couldn't seem to get it to work. She told the boy to get out of the house. He obeyed, running out into the yard, and the mother followed seconds later, holding the baby and shouting into her phone. The boy heard her shout at the fire department and then at the father. the nursery window filled with fire. Indeed, it looked as though the house were going to burn down. By the time the fire department arrived, the flames had consumed the nursery. The boys' room, and the parents' room. Firemen unrolled their hoses and aimed them at the fire. When the father arrived, it was all over. Half the house was black and smoking, and the corner of the roof was caved in. Sometime later, crouching in the yard in front of the boy, the father said, his teeth clenched, his face red, "Why? Why did you do this?" The boy, understanding that he had done something very wrong, but still convinced that there was a larger issue at stake, the issue of the parents' deception at the hands of the unscrupulous department store, said, "It didn't turn red. I was watching, and it didn't." Surely, the boy thought, the father would react with anger, or at least concern. Instead, he merely appeared confused. "It didn't turn red," the boy repeated. "It didn't work." He knew that this was not the right thing to say, that it would not make anything better, but it was all he had. So he kept on saying it, with increasing desperation and in between sobs, until the father loosened, at last, his angry grip on the boy's shoulders and took him into his arms. How's that for a happy ending? Speaking of happy endings, I'm coming into the home stretch here. I'm going to keep on reading for about 12 more minutes. This fabulous book by J. Robert Lennon, Book of Stories, the book title of which is Let Me Think, out on Grey Wolf Press. This guy tried, I mean, I'm just kidding, but he tried to be like me and write lots of really short stories, but some longer ones. Those were all from part one of the book. This will be the end of the show. It's the title story, Let Me Think. You're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. You're listening to me on my show, Good Night, Norman. You're listening to me on the radio, not my radio station, but yours, WGXC 90.7 FM, or WGXC.org on the worldwide interweb. Donate today online. Go to that site and become a sustaining member. So just like you pay for Amazon every month, you can pay for this. And they're not just paying for me. There's like not quite the variety that Amazon has, but there's a lot of different shows on this. Maybe I shouldn't mention Amazon, but I just did. So who cares? I was really talking about the river. This radio station is better than the Rio Amazon. Okay, Let Me Think, from the collection of the same name by J. Robert Lennon. Collection of stories. The father says to the child, "Let me think." Because the child is talking, she's been talking all morning, and he just wants to get this one tedious thing finished, and to do so, he needs a few minutes of silence. That is all. The child hesitates because this is a new command, let me think. The father is asking for permission, a position the child herself is often in. But the child is uncertain how to proceed. This power is new to her. She'll have to gather more information. She says, Daddy, what are you doing? Without turning to look at her, he says, I'm just hold on. Just let me think for a minute. The father's thinking of the ways the child is like her mother, determined, stubborn even, selectively, strategically oblivious to the obvious when it suits her needs. He is angry at the child for talking, and he's been angry all morning, though later he will misremember that his outburst, the one he already knows is coming, came out of nowhere. The child would like to let her father think, as he demanded she do, or rather at first she wanted to let him think. Now she is wondering if it might be more interesting to withhold the requested permission to not let her father think. But how? She says, Daddy? Then considers for a moment what to say next. Daddy, she says, how are you thinking? Which is not quite the question she meant to ask, and which does not entirely make sense. Her father says, I'm trying to work. What he is doing from the child's perspective is staring at the screen of a computer. The child understands that this can indeed mean that the father is working, but she knows it can also mean other things. She now doubts the veracity of her father's claim, and while she still doesn't fully understand the mechanism by which control of her father's thoughts rests with her, she does now see that it has something to do with talking. What her father wants is for her to stop talking. This makes no sense to the child, for talking to her is the ultimate form thoughts take, and so is virtually synonymous with thinking. To test this hypothesis, she says, while spinning in place with her arms outstretched, na 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 na. Shut up! The father screams, wheeling around in his chair, and he reaches for the child, intending to stop her spinning with a firm hand and compel her to face him squarely, but instead, his hand strikes her face, and she falls to the ground, theatrically. The child theatrically collapses onto the carpet, screeching, after an obvious moment of contemplation and calculation. Later, on the phone with his ex-wife, he'll make the mistake of sharing this observation that their child pretended to be hurt, which his ex-wife will recognize as an iteration upon the kind of complaint he often used to levy against her, that she is easily wounded and possessed of an exaggerated sense of injustice, that indeed she suffers from a persecution complex. She'll accuse him correctly of applying to his daughter the resentment he still feels toward her, and will threaten to involve their divorce lawyer in the conversation, which is to say she will implicitly threaten to alter in the wake of this borderline abusive act their custody agreement. At this point in the conversation, he will take a moment to let himself think and will realize that it is time to cut his losses and apologize, which he will do through clenched teeth. After all, he hadn't been working, not really. He had been trying to compose an apologetic email to his lover, the one he left his wife for, and who has proven to be as willful and complicated as both his ex-wife and himself, and who he now understands is about to break up with him. Indeed, even as he forces out his apology to his ex-wife, the breakup email is alighting in his inbox. Meanwhile, the child, alone in her room at her house, which is now called Mommy's House, will begin to comprehend that it is possible to simultaneously cultivate a hurt and recognize that it is imaginary. and that these seemingly contradictory states are in fact usefully complementary. There will be new thoughts for the child, as will be her resolve. I'm sorry. These will be new thoughts for the child, as will be her resolve, arriving fast in their wake to keep them to herself. Okay, that's from the collection of stories, Let Me Think, by J. Robert Lennon. I'm going to read you the last piece, back to René Dommal. Recollections Concerning a Werewolf. We leave it to each person to work out, following the preceding information, one's own lycanthropic technique. In concluding, we will limit ourselves to providing a few personal recollections. At a certain period of our life, we had the privilege of enjoying a friendly rapport with an authentic werewolf. He was a Jewish werewolf who lived inside the skin of an honorable shopkeeper. One of his greatest concerns in this era of incredulity was to prove his existence as a werewolf to his close friends. To others, of course, he displayed only the wisply sly mien of a slightly stupid businessman. He would cite to me ancient authors who had attested the existence of werewolves: Herodotus, Virgil, Strabo, Dionysius, Afer, Pomponius, Mela, etc. All these people, moreover, had good reasons not to deny the existence of werewolves. I knew them all personally, and you know, he said, baring his teeth and fixating on my carotid, you know that if I want to force someone to talk about me, I possess serious means of intimidation. Sic, 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 ita bene, non modo sod etiam, I answered hurriedly, for he was particularly fond of the language of Apuleius. He went on, it is I who suggested to Emperor Sigismund to convene a council of theologians that might determine once and for all what should be made of the existence of werewolves. I was present, wearing the habit of a cardinal, at their discussions, and, as you can well imagine, I did not hesitate to furnish him with peremptory arguments. The theologians, as you know, declared that not only must one believe in the existence of werewolves, but it would even be heretical not to believe in them. Later, they thought they were taking vengeance and discrediting me by spreading the opinion, thereafter common among modern demonographers, that the transformation of a man into a werewolf could not occur without the intercession of the devil in person. But contrary to what they had hoped,